to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking about all of the biggest stories that you never heard anything accurate about from the corporate mainstream. My guest today is Ole Damgaard. He's been uncovering the exact type of story that I think is so important and that is so covered up. He's one of our leading experts, not just on the American deep state, but the international deep state that is linked up with it. Ole Damgaard is a prize-winning author, investigator. He's a former journalist. He first took the red pill after looking into the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and discovered that it was linked to the usual suspects, the same sort of people who killed the Kennedys, Dr. King, and so many other political leaders, and who are behind so many other bad actions worldwide. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the latest wave of false flag terrorism, and it never seems to stop. But that's why we have to keep you informed about it. Welcome, Ole Damgaard. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you so much for having me back on.
Well, it's always good to have you. It seems like the false flag situation has worsened in recent years after 9/11, 7/7, Bali, Madrid, and so on. It seemed like maybe it was going to go back to sleep, or at least experienced a certain lull somewhere towards the latter part of the Bush presidency and on into the beginning of Obama's. And then we had a kind of a resurgence here in the U.S. with the Fort Hood shootings, the underwear bomber, and on and on and on. And it's gone international, and now it seems to be accelerating with various false flag events in Canada, in Ottawa, the Australian chocolate shop. Charlie Hebdo is the latest outrage, and the one that seems to be serving as France's 9/11. Maybe you can discuss a little bit the background to this Gladio B false flag crime wave that we're suffering through.
I'll be most happy to. First of all, I just want to explain the expression false flag operation. It's an old naval term. It was used in the old days by, in a way that if you wanted to attack an innocent country and so on, and you didn't want trouble with your neighboring countries or other forces or so on, what you did was you put the enemy's flag on your own ship, then you let that ship attack one of your other ships, and then that would justify you invading that country or beating the crap out of whoever. So this false flag technique has been used again and again and again so many times, and I would almost suggest that all wars in modern time have been started on false flag operations. So this is absolutely nothing new whatsoever. It's based also on an old Roman template called problem, reaction, solution. The people in power secretly create a problem to get a reaction from the population of the country or the world. The reaction they're striving for is an emotional, like a cry out, like, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then the population will turn towards the elite saying, please, please help us with this awful thing. And then they will serve you their solution, with a solution that would never, ever have been accepted had it not been for the problem. So problem, reaction, solution. And this type of terrorism has been going on for decades and decades. For many years, the CIA was using what they call the strategy of tension. And what they used or have been using is the Gladio network in Europe, and also taking it internationally. And
in the Gladio network was commanded by the American Pentagon, but it included stay behind armies organized by the Americans in Europe, ostensibly to fight against any Russian invasion. But the real purpose of Gladio morphed into this strategy of tension, meaning false flag terror attacks attributed to leftists in order to keep the right-wing American puppets in power in Europe.
Yeah, you're totally correct. It was every time there was any kind of signs of a lefty government or something like that, they hit the whatever society with so-called terror acts, freaking the population out and forcing them towards their savior, the more right-wing one, to accept more and more militarized police, to accept RoboCops, more and more surveillance, giving up our liberties, giving up our civil rights and human rights and so on. That is the thing that they're always looking for, to get you more and more in a very strong strangulation grip and around the balls as well, so that they've got you.
And isn't it ironic that they're taking away our freedom using this terror strategy, and yet the talking point that they use is that they hate our freedom. After 9/11, we were told that the evil Muslim extremists hate our freedom, and that's why we have to eliminate our freedom by shredding the Bill of Rights. And likewise, now after Charlie Hebdo, it's the same thing. The French government says these radical Muslims hate our freedom, so we need to go and arrest everybody who's saying anything that we don't like.
It is such a twisted logic. You really have to bend your mind to get around it. How they managed to pull this off, because it's so weird, the whole setup. But I would very much suggest that they repeat their patterns again and again, the way of carrying them out, but also the motive behind it and so on, the fake evidence that they plant and so on. And with this latest one, if you remember, first it was the Satanic Verses with Salman Rushdie. Then that was Khomeini that put that one out. But I think that they got inspired and saw that that could really get the fire going.
And so, I don't know whether that was a false flag, but there may have been a false flag component to it. As I understand it, the wave of sort of anti-Satanic Verses demonstrations that broke out in Muslim communities around the world began in England. And somebody did a media event in England in which I think they maybe burned a picture of Rushdie or a copy of the book or something like that. They did a big spectacular thing that went out all over the media. And the question is, the people who did that, were they Muslims who honestly were angry at Rushdie, or was there some infiltrator? Because the media coverage was so overblown. You know, if I go out there and stage a demonstration, Oli, let's say I'm an angry Muslim, which I am. So let's say I go out in public and I burn a picture of Netanyahu and I say, I'm doing this because Netanyahu is behind 9/11 and a lot of these other terror outrages. He needs to be prosecuted and hanged, something like that. Guess what? It's not going to go all over the world's media. The Zionist media is not going to cover it. Yet when these Muslims went and did an anti-Rushdie demonstration, it was only, I think, a few dozen people or something, maybe less than a dozen, just a handful of people went out, did an anti-Salman Rushdie demonstration, and it was blasted all over the world. And so then copycat demonstrations sprang up, and the next thing you know, it became this huge deal. And over in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was a shrewd politician as well as a very brilliant intellectual and spiritual leader, saw this and said, yeah, let's make an issue of this and show that Islam is back and we're not going to be taking this kind of stuff from the West anymore. And so he, you know, put the fatwa on Rushdie, and the rest was history. So it's questionable whether there was a false flag aspect to that. Do you think there might have been?
The first one, I have no idea. What I do know is that the reaction, just like you say, in the global media was so overwhelming. That one was totally out of proportion to what actually was done in Salman Rushdie's book.
And if I do a book promotion, if I do a book promotion stunt like that, you know, if I were able to,
that is the perfect one.
Yeah, I could sell millions of copies, for example, of this new book that we're working on right now called "We Are Not Charlie Hebdo," and you know, if I came up with some stunt to try to publicize this "I Am Not Charlie Hebdo" book. Somehow I just don't think it's going to go all over the whole world's media, leading to the sales of tens of millions of copies of the book. Just not going to happen, because I guess I don't have the connections that Rushdie had, or maybe the people who control the media are just not interested in publicizing my book the way that they were apparently interested in publicizing Rushdie's.
No, and also, just like you say, Khomeini, Ruhollah Khomeini, he was a very shrewd politician as well as a religious leader. So he would have understood, I think, that by putting a thing like that on Salman Rushdie, that without that, nobody would have read the book. It's not, in my opinion, it's not even a good book in any way or form. But this gave him global publicity, and it has sold millions and millions. Nobody would have noticed it had it not been published.
Right, and of course, the reason that the Ayatollah Khomeini did this was not to publicize the book, but rather for really internal political reasons in Iran and within the larger Islamic awakening. He was actually playing into a kind of strategy of tension himself in order to try to increase the power of political Islam in general and the Islamic awakening in Iran in particular.
Yeah. So the first one, I don't know false flag, but I know, I think that these people in the Gladio network, the CIA and so on, that they got inspired by that. They saw that, this is something we can play with. And it, some years ago, there was a Danish, it was almost identical to what happened in Paris, but not in a, such a violent way. There was a Danish newspaper that that published some cartoons of, I think, Muhammad or something like that, caricatures. And that started a whole global thing again, you know, burning flags and all this thing.
You're talking about the Danish cartoon scandal?
Yeah.
So now I think, that was false flag. I mean, there were connections to neoconservatives with that particular publication.
Exactly. And so now I think they're just repeating the theme. You know, they've seen, okay, this one is a one we can use, you know, because then we can go for the liberty to express yourself, the freedom of expression. That one, that always gets, that and patriotism are things that can really get the population going, and then blame it on the Muslims. Great combo. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is what they did this time as well. And I just want to say that I spent about 30 years looking into these major assassinations, false flag operations, and so on. I had two friends of mine that was very tragically murdered. I had to leave my country because of threats and so on. And when I'm now living in Spain, when we came to Spain, we came with nothing and so on. So I started working with any kind of job I could find. And one of the first jobs I got was as an extra on film sets on Mallorca. There's a small company there. So I've been in a background extra, film productions, commercials, you name it. And the thing was that it's a very, very boring job. It's like they point out in this scene you have to point, you have to walk from point A to point B. They put cue markers and they do the same with all the background extras so that the background will be, contingent. It will, whatever many takes they take, the background will always be the same.
Yeah, so that when continuity.
Continuity. Thank you, Kevin. That because you need, when you cut it together, the background action needs to be the same. So because this is a very boring job, you have to spend hours and hours sitting waiting. I just spent that time trying to learn, you know, so I was walking around looking at films and sets and asking questions about the whole setup. So I learned a lot about how it's done and so on. And when you do a film shoot in a city, the producers, they go to the local authorities, and one of the first thing they do, they get a permission to close off that section of the street so that they are in total control of what happens there. So any vehicle in that area, even parked cars, any people in the background, all of that will be your people. You cannot have normal pedestrians walking across suddenly staring into the camera going, what's up here, you know, what are you doing?
Right, waving and smiling at the camera.
That's the one. So what they always tell background actors is do not look into the camera. And you will see that when these things happen, when they're false flag, a staged event, the background action, even though that is where the things happen, they never look into the camera. They never look in that direction, which would be the normal reaction if something violent happens.
In Paris, only wasn't there? There were cameras, including the one by the Polish worker, right above where these supposed terrorists were escaping from Charlie Hebdo, who were filming seemingly totally nonchalant, relaxed, didn't look like they were worried. They were just right above the supposed terrorists carrying these AK-47s or whatever. This is very strange.
When I come to a crime scene, I try to come in with an open mind and just then don't not have any
preconceptions.
Preconception. I just look at the evidence, look at the witnesses, what did they see, what did they say, and try to get the absolute first time of footage, anything before anything get edited or deleted, and so because it has a very bad habit of disappearing within hours from when this actual thing happens. So when you look at this one, especially if we begin with the one where I think most people have seen, where they very brutally execute this police officer who's wounded and lying on the pavement. If that really happened, awful, awful, awful. So, but let's have a look and let's just see what normal logic, like 1 + 1 = 2. Let's use that logic for a little while. When you see the car, for instance, that these two so-called terrorists arrived in, you will see that, I need to reverse, when you do a film set, one of the things when there are vehicles involved is that you put cue markers for the driver. This is exactly where you should stop at, on this spot and so on. It's because of camera angles, sound equipment and so on. So what they do, they often paint like cue markers on the street, okay? And that is both sideways and lengthwise so that you get an exact coordination. This is where you should stop. So we look at this car that these two so-called terrorists are riding in. If you look under the car, right in the center middle under the car, in the front of the car, is a black line. This is exactly the type of lines they would put there. On the side of the passenger side, there's a trainer, a shoe standing right outside the door, under the door on the passenger side. That one belongs to the terrorist, because you can see when they run back, one of them bends down and picks up the shoe, throws it in the car, and they take off. You check out the feet of these guys, both of them have shoes on. So it is their shoe, but it's not, they haven't dropped it. But when you look at these two, the line and the shoe, that makes an exact coordination of where the car should stop. Hmm. You then look at the car itself. It's as far as I've been able to find out, it's a Citroën C3 2014 with chrome side mirrors. You look at the car that was later found where the ID was
that was quite an amazing, yeah, they claimed it was fortuitous. We never would have caught these guys, except one of them accidentally left his ID card in the abandoned getaway car.
This is the exact thing, you know. He didn't drop his wallet, he didn't drop anything, he dropped that exact same thing, exactly like 9/11 with a passport out there. And it's only through this ID that they found the brothers. So if you look at that car, that it's lifted up and they have the whole technical team there checking everything out, you check that car out, it's a Citroën C3 2013, not 2014, with black side mirrors, not the same vehicle.
Really?
Okay, so that one on its own should just be a dead giveaway. Check it out for yourself, I'm not making this up. Then you have, you see the two terrorists, they run out, the guy on the driver's seat, he runs up. When he runs up to the pavement, there's a white cue marker. Then when he passes the victim and runs down into the street again, there's another cue marker. And when he turns around in the street, there's another white cue marker. Exactly how you would have done it when you do rehearsals. Okay, this is where you do this, that, and the. These markers, should this be a film set, are right there. Then you have the police officer who, if you listen to it, there's some shots fired, and you have this guy, he's rolling around on the pavement, apparently hit. He's holding onto his leg and so on. And the normal human reaction when you are hurt or if you're shot and so on is to put your hands on the wound, try to stop the blood or whatever. You see here, once the terrorist gets closer, this police officer lifts both his palms up towards the shooter. No blood on his hands, meaning no wound on the leg or wherever he was shot. Then you have... it is said that, or you look at this this so-called terrorist, he runs by very relaxed. I've been to war zones, I've been to situations where people are shooting for real. there's a lot of adrenaline in the air, a lot of tension, you know, a lot of these things. These guys, they run like they were out jogging. No tension, no, you know, this whole thing. And the terrorist, he just runs by the police officer, fires a shot right into the head of this guy, executes him, but doesn't check if he was hit or anything like that. So we amplify this image majorly and slows it down in extreme slow motion. What you see is there's absolutely no recoil from this AK-47. An AK-47, 7.62 millimeter, it's a powerful gun. And if you shoot it like that, there would be a definite recoil and a massive impact to wherever it's hit. You look at the body of this police officer, absolutely no reaction to the impact of the bullet. Nothing.
No blood?
No blood, no nothing. That his head would have been a mess, I tell you. If you've been to war zone, it's awful. Here, nothing. Then you see that there, it looks like there's a ricochet from the pavement. But once you zoom in on it, you will see that the smoke that comes actually comes from the left hand of the police officer lying down. It's some kind of smoke canister that goes off, and it goes off in an upward angle to the right. You then compare this image with the footage later. If you compare to where the police officer's body is, there's a signpost and you just nearby. And if you compare the location of the signpost and the police officer, the blood that is later seen on the scene is not in the correct position. And there's a BBC reporter later the same day that goes out and he says, oh my God, it's awful, this police officer has been shot, people have been here with candles and flowers, it's such a tragedy. And here you see where the blood has been put. That is his words, where the blood has been put, you know. And then you look at the, this is a Freudian slip in my opinion, then you look at the amount of blood when he's standing there, it's like 3-4 square meters of blood that's been there. Nothing if you compare to where the police officer had his head, and also when if you look at footage when they lift him onto a stretcher, nothing. You will also see that there's some images of people giving him, is it called CPR in English? You know, heart massage to get his heart going. You would never, ever do that to somebody with a headshot, because that would just, you know, the damage to the injury, the head injury would just be fatal.
Very interesting. So this looks like another of these kinds of staged operations, the hyper-realistic filmmaking, they call it, where they stage something in public that is made to look real.
Can I continue a little bit here, just to add some more details around
the whole
thing?
Sure, please do.
Okay, when you do these things, what you do is afterwards, there's a lot of after work or after effects where they add, you know, sound effects and so on. And if you look, if you really turn the sound out, you will hear that they're playing children in the background. It sounds like there's a playground nearby and so on. They're laughing and so on. Here, they're laughing, shots are fired, they keep laughing. They keep laughing, playing. That is not normal. If you've been to a war zone or when shots are fired, people freak out. They start screaming or they run away, but they do not keep on playing and laughing. So I would very much say that this sound has been added afterwards. Also, the shots fired, it's very, very powerful. I mean, it sounds very impressive. But if you listen to it, the type of sound sounds like it's been recorded between, like when there are walls on both sides of the street. Here we have an open park area where the type of echo would be different. That is my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so these are a lot of indications that this was basically staged.
Totally. And then you have this thing with, there's another where video film, where you see this black car. Every single time they film something, there are no other vehicles. Please notice that. It's the police vehicle or the escape car. These two, nothing else. There's another footage where you see that the car with the two terrorists are stopping, and they come front to front with a police car, and they jump out and they start shooting out from the windows and so on the police car that then very fast starts reversing and disappears. When you look at the escape car from these terrorists, the rear window is smashed. I don't know where did that come from, but it's smashed. Okay, you compare that later to the car that was abandoned. There's a footage taken from above. Then the rear mirror is fine. It's not. It's pristine. You look at this. It said that this police car reversed very fiercely backwards, and because they panicked when they were being shot at, there are lots of bullet holes in the front window. And what happens is that it said that they reversed and crossed one of the main streets behind them, and then hammered right into a parked car, a silver-colored parked car. You look at the images once again, you see that the impact on the police car, the rear of the police car, is very high compared to where it should have hit the silver-colored car. The damages does not match up, you know. And also the damages to the silvery car does not fit into where the impact should have been. Then you see there's another one where they film from above some rooftops, and there's people hiding up there. You know, it's so dramatic. We're talking like 10, 15 meters up in the air, like 8, 10 floors up on one of these rooftops up there, and you have like 5, 6 people running around hiding. You slow it down again, go into slow motion, zoom into the details. For one thing, why are they hiding up there? They could have just stayed indoors, so there's absolutely no risk or whatever up there. But they are. They're hiding behind walls and so on. And then you start checking out the people up there. Two of them have bulletproof vests on.
Well, I guess they're trying to be extra safe.
They were very lucky that day going to the office, you know. Let's bring the bulletproof just in case.
Yeah, they picked the right day for that.
Then you zoom in down on the street level where you see there's no cars, no pedestrians, nothing down there. I would say closed off street once again. And then you have three figures running in black clothes with white writing on the back. In the exact same spot where French police officers have the writing police on the back. They run, and then a little bit later there are two people following them, the so-called terrorists. But the timeline says it was the opposite way around, that the terrorists were running and the police followed. Mistake again. Then you have the location where the getaway car was abandoned, and somebody has taken a photo from above. Down, you can see the car, there are two zebra crossings, two pedestrian crossings with their white lines. There are some, I don't know what you call them, like metal sticks of things to get people avoid parking there, that are sitting there. So you can count from the white lines to where the vehicle is standing. You look at that, that's the photo where the rear window is fine. The doors are open and these people have escaped.
Now, is that where they supposedly abandoned one car and then carjacked another one?
You tell me, but that as far as I know, yes, that's the one. It's exactly where the whole, you see all these images of these, the forensic team comes and checks everything out, and so that's it. But when you look at the car where the forensic team is investigating and checking everything out, you go down Google Earth, you go down a Google Map street level, look around, compare the different restaurants and where the pedestrians crossings are and so on, you will see that the car that they investigated is not positioned in the same car as where the getaway car was positioned. It is like 2 meters to the right. That's where the official car stands. So it looks almost to me like both of the cars have been at one point standing next to each other. You know, they just exchanged them. They had the whole thing going with a setup, and here, leave the car, take a photo, then that car out of the picture, in comes the car with the planted evidence. Because when you see the distance that doesn't match, it's exactly the space for another car next to it if you park them next to each other. Hmm. Then you have the witnesses when they went into this newspaper thing and fired around. One of the witnesses, oh my God, I got so scared. He has so clear blue eyes. You look at the images of the people accused for it. None of them have blue eyes. Brown eyes, brown eyes, brown eyes. And also it's the exact same thing where, the trend of blaming or using Muslims as patsies. Muslims and black people as well. The last 10, 15 years, these are the favorite patsies. In the old days, it used to be Russians and East Germans during the Cold War. There were no Muslim terrorists at all. And then they ran out and they couldn't use it when the war came down. They tried with the alien threat. No, that didn't work either. So who are we going to hit? Who are we going to use? The Muslims, that's the perfect one, because they have a very strange names that most people think sounds very odd, like Muhammad, Abdullah, Karim, Karunka, or something like that. They come from countries that most people have no idea, and then they've got the big dark eyebrows, a big mustache, black hair, and so on, and dark skin. Perfect. That looks really threatening to many people. So it's so much easier to persuade the population that, yep, that's the guy, that's the guy. And I mean, it's come to a level where if you just mention Islam, people think terrorism. And if you say Muslim, terrorist. And if your name is Abdullah, my God, you got terrorist printed in your forehead. And it's just absolutely not true when you really look into these events. Because I tell you, after 30 years, I'm not even sure that there is such a thing as a real terrorist, because it's just staged event or inside jobs again and again and again and again.
Well, I think there are episodes of resistance in occupied countries, and of course Palestine is the big one. There has been resistance, mostly nonviolent resistance and protests and so on, but also people have fought to defend Palestine against the genocidal invaders who've come and essentially thrown most of the population into what amounts to open-air concentration camps. So there is that resistance, and then when the U.S. invades Iraq or Afghanistan, or when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, for that matter, of course, there is serious armed resistance. But it seems to me, Oli, that you can tell which are the false flags and what's the real resistance, because the real resistance is usually happening in the country that's been invaded and occupied, and to the extent that these very spectacular incidents in the European country or in the U.S. Are obviously designed to increase Euro-American support for invasion and occupation of Muslim countries rather than the reverse. It's obvious who did it. It's a who benefits thing. I mean, no Vietnamese fighter was stupid enough to think that going and blowing up skyscrapers in New York would actually stop the Americans from fighting in Vietnam. They knew that that would actually increase American will to fight in Vietnam. And in war, as you know, everything that you do in a war is designed to convince or force the opponent to stop fighting. And mostly you want to convince them. 99% of war is psychological, as everybody back to Sun Tzu has known. So every act of war, including these staged theatrical PR events, should be evaluated in terms of its effect on the conflict. Who is it going to persuade to stop fighting? Who is it going to persuade to fight even more? And these false flag events are obviously all designed to bring the West into a much more intense phase of its invasion and occupation of Muslim countries, especially occupied Palestine, which is ground zero for the whole thing.
I think you're spot on there. And they say that this is an armed conflict, that there's this thing being... If you compare it, it's like sending in Mike Tyson into a nursery, and then an infant bites his finger, and he just crushes the skull of this baby. That's the same type of thing. And you say, no, they're fighting each other, or they're not. They're being slaughtered. That's it. That's it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see it if you open your eyes. And what you pointed out as well, it's so important to see not only the false flag or the so-called event, see the solution. What is it that they try to push onto us? What is it where nowadays you will see it in media so quickly, you know, they serve you the problem. They say, oh my God, there's been this new mass shooting. It's awful, it's awful, it's awful. They interview somebody on the pavement or in the neighborhood or something like that. This person is very often part of the staged event. And the person will say, oh, they behaved like savages. They were just whatever, chopping the head of babies or eating them alive or something like that to get the reaction going. And then the reporter will serve you the solution so that your brain will not even have time to recuperate. It would be problem, reaction, solution. We have to have heightened securities, this, we have school, that you need to give up your guns, you blame the Muslims, and sorry about that, but we also need to take away all your civil rights and liberties and so on.
Well, and getting back to some details about Charlie Hebdo, have you seen the work of Hisham Hamza at penhamza.com, who's been investigating this? He points out that I believe it's the same abandoned getaway car was dropped off in the Marais district in Paris, which I used to live just blocks from there by the Bastille. These people, they dropped off this getaway car right in front of a Zionist-owned boulangerie and pâtisserie and café, a store that is actually used by the Israeli Defense Forces for their annual celebration of the Israeli military. That was a very strange place to flee. After these guys shot Charlie Hebdo, they go straight to the headquarters of the Israeli Defense Forces in Paris and drop the car off right in front of this headquarters and then grab there's an old man, and they grab his car and drive away in his car. You know, they carjacked him. But it looks all staged. And this was lunch hour. So this cafe should have been full of customers who saw all this right through the windows. And yet the media has never gone there and interviewed any of those people. Not one. There are, you know, the very, very few witness reports to this whole thing. And this is just one of the many Israeli connections to this Charlie Hebdo affair, which looks like it was probably done by Israeli intelligence with their Sayanim, or unpaid volunteers. And, of course, there are tens of thousands of these Sayanim who work for free for Israeli intelligence, not just Mossad, but these other agencies as well, which can count on their support for staging whatever kinds of operations they need to stage all over the world, including false flags. And it sure looks like Charlie Hebdo was done by this Israeli nexus, including their assets in French intelligence. Have you looked into also Jeanette Bougrab, the woman who came forward on television saying that she was this guy, the editor of Charlie Hebdo's girlfriend, and you know that he was like the father of her children and stuff? It turns out that that has been denied by the guy's family, and in fact, the hypothesis would be that Charlie Hebdo, which was in terrible financial trouble, was apparently rescued through big payments channeled through this Jeanette Bougrab, who is essentially an Israeli intelligence asset, which that money went to Charlie Hebdo to pay them to publish these extremely outrageous, blasphemous, pornographic, scurrilous attacks on Islam in order to set up this false flag. And the police officer who was investigating this connection, Elric Fredou, suicided himself. He was suicided that late that night, the same night as Charlie Hebdo. He was looking into this fake family relationship between Jeanette Bougrab and the editor of Charlie Hebdo, and suddenly he turns up dead with a bullet in his head right after he had been ordered off the case by his superior, who was a guy, I think Friedman is the guy's name, a Jewish name, and apparently a Zionist. So this Jewish cop orders Fredou off the case. Fredou refuses to leave the case. And then next thing you know, like, you know, 1 a.m. that night, he's very excited about a lead he's found regarding Jeanette Bougrab and her relationship to Charlie Hebdo. And suddenly, boom, he turns up with a bullet in the head. And they call it a suicide. but his family has not been allowed to see the autopsy, even though under French law, they're supposed to be able to see it. They were told, you will never see the autopsy. So here we have an apparently murdered police detective who was investigating the case and its connections to Israel, who apparently was murdered. So what do you think about these aspects, and especially also Hamza's work at PamHamza.com?
You know, the thing is, if this was only one thing, one occurrence, if this was only one thing, if I never seen that pattern before, I would say, okay, interesting, could be
a million coincidences, lots of coincidences.
But these are standard ingredients in these false flag operations. They happen again and again and again. And by the way, did you know that the Rothschild front bought Charlie Hebdo just a month before this happened? And normally they printed about 60,000 copies. After this, I think they went up to 7 million. So not only did they make an incredible bundle there, but also I think that it's a mistake to see that this was a Mossad operation. Because when you look at these things, I'm a friend of Chip Tatum, a CIA whistleblower, he was a deep cover agent for 25 years, black op assassin. He was one of the Night Stalker pilots. He was one of the pilots in the Iran-Contra. And he was part of the Pegasus, an ultra-secret hit team under the direct control of George Bush Sr. They carried out at least 14 or 17 assassinations internationally. I mean, he's the real deal. And he's been part of false flag operations as well. What Chip says is that when you look at these operations, they are almost always in cooperation. Some, like the CIA works together with the Mossad, works together with whatever countries, local security police and so on, so that they get the local backup and with safe houses, the logistics, weapon, maps, food and so on to the hit teams and so on. And so if, for instance, the CIA have a problem in one country or the MI6, if the MI6 can't carry it out themselves, they just call in their colleagues from CIA or Mossad and so on. So very, very often it's a cooperation between these forces that looks very separated on a low level, but the higher up in the power pyramid you come, the more you see that they're connected on that level. And so here I feel very strongly that we're looking at an international job here, a coalition of the people carrying it out. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that I really think that they have taken this sort of like almost like a global rock tour where you set together a show, you know, with an artist, and then you go on the road, you do a world tour. I would very much suggest that the people that we've seen in Sandy Hook, in the Boston bombing, many of these mass shootings are now going globally, like the Ottawa shooting, the Sydney shooting, the Woolwich beheading and so on. I would very much like, if anyone has the time, to start checking out the background, the people in the background, and start comparing facial structures and these things, and see if I'm correct in that thing. Because, you know, just after the Paris thing, while it was still going on, there were some images shown on in some international newspapers, one of them being the Daily Mail, and so on. And there was some photos of the forensic team checking out the crime scene and so on. There's especially one guy in a white overall with orange gloves and a helmet and a facial mask and so on. He's behind a window that has been smashed in checking out things. When I saw that, I thought, I know this image. I've seen it before. So I started looking around. It is the identical image that was used at the NAACP bombings in Colorado just a week before. Identical.
Wow. So they're reusing the images.
They've reused. I don't get
recycling.
It. But it's very clumsy. Uh-huh. Then if I can just take you to another country, we go to Pakistan on the 21st of December 2014. That is the exact date when the Sandy Hook shooting was taking place, two years earlier. In Peshawar, you had this awful, awful school shooting where lots of children was massacred by some crazy people running around shooting it. You look at the crime scene, once again, very strange, you know, like bullet holes in the walls. It looks like chaos had been done there. But the blood spatter or the blood or whatever from a normal crime scene, it does not, you cannot see it there. You can just see blood being poured, that has been like poured on the ground. And blood has, real blood, depending on where the wound is, it would have different colors. If it's very oxygenated, with lots of oxygen, it's going into the pinkish color. And other, depending on where the wound is, it can go very dark. But one thing that it always does, it goes brownish when it dries up. Here, with these crime scene photos, it's always very, very bright red, this very strong red color, which is the exact color of theater.
14. februar 2015 bliver Danmark ramt af det værste terrorangreb i nyere tid. Klokken cirka 16.
Red. And from the office in at the Charlie Hebdo, the splatter pattern, no splatter patterns, no nothing. It does not match a normal crime scene. So we go to this thing in Peshawar, where you got this awful tragedy. You got this standard thing with flowers and candles and photos of the victims and so on. You start looking into the images, and what images is of Noah Posner, a 6-year-old boy that was killed in Sandy Hook. In Peshawar. So when I saw that, and it's not in one place, I checked out many different international newspapers.
14. februar 2015 bliver Danmark ramt af det værste terrorangreb i nyere tid. Klokken cirka 16.30 dukker den formodede gerningsmand op foran kulturhuset Krudttønden. Målet er et debatter.
Exactly on the date, 2 years. So there's also like there's a BBC news thing where there's a female reporter in Peshawar. She's in a green dress and she's walking along a long wall where the photos of the victims are. If you go to BBC's own news site, there's a video where there's a returning boxer from Pakistan, or a Pakistani boxer who comes home to share his grief with the victim, families of the victims and so on. Click on that one and you will see what I'm talking about. She walks along the wall and she says, oh my God, this awful, awful tragedy has happened, and here families and friends are gathered around to celebrate the memories of the victim. She walks along this wall of photos and boom, there you go. Noah Posner, right there to her side. This is a video footage, so it's not like Photoshop image that has put in there. Then you have, it just goes on and on. It's so like, what's going on? But here you have, once again, problem, reaction, solution. You have this awful shooting, the reaction from the world, oh my God. And what is their solution? They want to execute 500 so-called terrorists. 500. And who are these so-called terrorists, and who have labeled them terrorists? I mean, the thing is that nowadays, Kevin, people like you and me are what is being labeled terrorists, because just because we're trying to uncover the truth, this is where they want to take it. And to execute 500 people for a crime committed by a few, but because of this awful thing, we accept that the population doesn't even raise an eyebrow.
Well, in Pakistan, there's a whole, you know, different situation from, say, in the U.S. with Sandy Hook. In Pakistan, there really is a tremendous amount of violence being attributed to the so-called Pakistani Taliban. And this is not all fake violence by any means, of course. The Pakistani Taliban, however, was supposedly created in 2004 by the CIA, and it's basically a destabilization operation against Pakistan designed to take down Pakistan and ultimately break it into pieces and eliminate its nuclear weapons. Now, just because we have this Noah Posner picture in both Sandy Hook and Pakistan doesn't necessarily mean that either of these shootings didn't happen, although I do think that there are good reasons to question Sandy Hook. But it seems to me that the people in the media are responsible for a lot of this, you have to wonder whether there's a kind of a signaling going on. Like when they put the same victim's photo in both places to basically inform each other that, yeah, this was one of our jobs. In the same way that they use numerology. You know, they use, you know, 9/11, and then exactly 900 days after 9/11 was the Madrid operation. And, you know, these they pick numerologically interesting dates, 7/7 and so on. These kinds of things seem like they may be sort of tags in the way that graffiti artists would tag a scene to identify that they were the ones who were there. These Illuminati, whoever they are, these criminals, like to tag their crime scenes because they control the media, so they can make sure that the media puts out what they wanted to put out, so they can put the same victim's picture for both stories, regardless of what may have actually happened at either place. In the same way, they can give us, you know, numbers. The numbers of victims of these things almost always have an 11 in them, I've noticed. These kinds of reports are controlled by the media. So because they control the media, they can put this these little touches into their stories. And these touches don't necessarily mean that the entire operations that they're covering were purely staged and nobody got hurt, because in a lot of these operations, a lot of people did get hurt. In Pakistan, I suspect that there were, according to some reports, as many as 500 kids may have been killed, not just the 100 or so that we heard, because the government there is trying to essentially stabilize itself. And likewise, the going after the so-called Pakistani Taliban is also a kind of a desperate attempt by the Pakistani government to save itself from the kind of destabilization that overthrew the government of Libya and Iraq in a slightly different way, Somalia, and so on. So I think we have to look at the context of each of these places, and also keep in mind that the media, the controlled media, is putting out signals, and apparently, you know, with almost a kind of a demonic glee in these things, like reusing the same pictures of the victims in these two instances.
I can only say I don't understand what's going on. I'm just pointing out things that shows that weird things is happening here. Mm-hmm. And also, you said about the date. This is exactly 2 years on the date from when Noah Posner was officially killed. Mm-hmm. And if you go to FBI's own website, you check out Newport, where Sandy Hook is located. You check 2012, the number of homicides in that area, and it's only a few compared to all the victims of Sandy Hook. So they haven't even put it on their own website to get it properly in order. You know, it's just many of these things are very sloppy. They're not so focused on details, I would say.
Because they own the media, so they can control the media coverage. And
yeah,
and they send us messages saying, we control the media, that's why we can put Posner's face in these two separate reports 2 years apart.
Maybe that's why. I don't know. I'm just pointing it out. And also, when you think of it, I mean, they're doing the same thing again and again and again, and we're buying it. So, I mean, I can totally understand that they don't have a lot of respect for us, because we are very asleep in their eyes.
Mm-hmm. So, indeed. So how are we going to wake up to the point that, you know, do you think that if we actually got a prosecution of one of these cases, you know, if there was one country where there was enough of the judiciary and police that was honest and upset about this, that by actually prosecuting one of these cases, we could perhaps start a movement that would ultimately fix the situation?
I tell you, I don't have any faith in official authorities or government or anything like that. Absolutely not. I think that we need to take the power back. And one of the ways I would suggest is that when these false flags are carried out, a very, very typical ingredient in these false flag operations are the so-called drills. More or less every single time there's a drill going on at the same time with the exact same scenario, and then right in the middle of it, suddenly goes live. So many people who are even involved in the drill have absolutely no idea that it's an actual event that takes place. You know, at the 7/7, you had the exact same drill going on as what was carried out with the different subway stations and the bus blowing up and so on. to the extent that police officers that were part of the drill were standing outside the entrance to some of the subway stations, and the bomb went off and people came out dying, blown to pieces and screaming, crying out. And the police officer was just standing there saying, oh my God, it looks so real. I mean, you can't even imagine how good they are, these actors. They didn't understand that it was actually happening. They thought that it was a drill. So the same with the sinking of the MS Estonia, with 9/11, you had several drills going on. Boston Marathon, you had drills going on there and so on. So I would say, up until now, we have looked at these things after they've happened. We've had to look into all the details, trying to see, is it real, is it not, what's going on and so on. Why not see if we can be one step ahead of them? So the next time you see in your local paper or something like that there's going to be a drill, a mass shooting drill or whatever it is, some kind of drill when it comes to these things, bring your video camera, bring your mobile, bring your friends, go down there. It will look like a film set, more or less, like there will be strange vehicles, trucks with material, buses with extras, streets will be closed up. Film them, make it very obvious that they're being observed. Film them, stream it live on YouTube if you can and so on. So that if this had a sinister agenda, then that would bring the message to them that don't even think of it. Don't even think about pulling that trigger. We know what you're up to, you know. And I've been pumping this out in many different arenas. And a little while ago, a few weeks ago, I got a photo sent by a friend saying, I just took this photo of a poster in Copenhagen saying that there was a drill at one of the major train stations in Copenhagen. This was the night between the 14th and the 15th of January. He said, could this be such an event? I said, yes, thank you so much, thank you. And what I did, I pumped it all over the place saying the exact same thing. Please go there, film it, make it very obvious that you're there observing them. Nothing happened. Lots of people went there. Absolutely nothing happened.
All right. Well, this would be a great new movement or website. WeKnowTheDrill.com. And we do know the drill. And thanks to people like you. Ollie, we're kind of hitting up against the end of the hour here.
Can I just finish with one thing, Kevin?
Okay.
It's like Chip Tatum, who's been part of Force Black Operation, he said that these things are planned in very great detail to have like a very detailed timeline where things are depending on what is happening along the timeline. So every time we can disturb the timeline, he said it can mess it up for months for the people trying to carry these things out. So the more we can interrupt and mess up their timeline, the better, and then maybe we can stop this madness.
Okay, well, we're going to have to mess up the timeline of Truth Jihad Radio. Thank you so much, Ole Damgaard. I appreciate your terrific work at lightonconspiracies.com. Keep it up.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.